do you hear this from folks? Because I get it from folks. Every once in a while, you know, like my mom will be like, well, aren't you worried that the LSAT, the LSAT's going away, isn't it?
Hello and welcome to episode 450 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Ben Olson. With me is Nathan Fox. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous, share news, and ask questions on our website. That's thinkinglsat.com. Nathan, you have a class coming up in a couple days now on April 18th. That's at 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern.
All levels, all topics. All you need is an LSAT Demon free account. It's the same class that I teach twice a week in LSAT Demon Live. We're going to cover a reading comprehension passage. We're going to cover a handful of logical reasoning questions, and we're going to cover a game. We'll do the game last because lots of people are going to take the LSAT in August and beyond when the games are gone. So come to that class, and if you want to peace out on the games, you can peace out on the games. If you want to hang out and talk about the game, you are more than welcome to do so. Just go to lsatdemon.com/free. I'm super happy, Ben. I'm super proud of what we've been able to do with LSAT Demon free. We're just north of 53,000 free accounts now, all time. And there are so many resources there that are built to actually help people. It's not just marketing. It's not just bullshit. So if you sign up for an LSAT Demon free account, you're going to have access to full tests, timed sections, tons of questions, our best in class written explanations, best videos that are available, and the ask button where you can ask a team of tutors questions about those questions. So we've gotten tons of great feedback about LSAT Demon free. And I really encourage listeners of the show, if you haven't done so already, please sign up for a free account and check out what the Demon is all about. You'll also start getting invites to classes like the one that I'm doing on April 18th. Again, that's 6 p.m. Pacific, 9 p.m. Eastern. It's a two-hour LSAT class with me. Hope to see you guys there.
Again, you can sign up for that at lsatdemon.com/free. Not this week, but next week is the registration deadline for the June 2024 LSAT. Not much to say there, except it's coming up soon. That's the last test you can take with games.
Right. Wow. Yeah. So the April test, I guess, is happening soon, in what, a week or two?
By the time of this recording, it will be over.
Oh, it's already gone. Okay. Yep. So there is one more shot at the games. The games is the most perfectible section of the LSAT. And for those of you who have been making some progress in the games, or who see it as a fun puzzle and feel like you're, you know, you could wrap your head around it between now and June, it's a pretty big opportunity for those who choose to accept it. If you don't, the games are going away and you're going to have an additional section of logical reasoning. Remember that the test is only, you know, it's only one third of the test that's changing. And all you're getting is an additional section of something that already exists. So it's not like it's a wildly dramatic change to the test. But that June 2024 test does still look like a pretty good opportunity for those of you who are good at or improving at the games.
Awesome. This first email is from Anonymous, and it's addressed to you, Nathan.
Oh, hi, Nathan. I was chatting with some colleagues the other day explaining my, quote, journey to law school and really hyping up the LSAT. One of them mentioned how the LSAT is going away in 2025. I tried to explain that the games are going away later this year and that schools aren't required to use the LSAT anymore, but that isn't going anywhere with them. I was unable to convince them. Could you guys maybe address the LSAT is going away people? There seems to be a lot of confusion about the ABA not requiring the LSAT. P.S. I still listen every Monday morning despite almost being finished with law school and never needing to look at an LSAT question again for the rest of my life. What do you want? Do you hear this, Ben? Do people? I get it from like friends and family. I get it from like my parents. Who you got to meet the other night.
Yeah.
Since I'm still here in D.C., we had dinner with you and Maria and my mom and dad, which was fun. I appreciate you guys coming out.
Yeah, it was fun to meet them finally. And they're very nice, of course.
They said the same about you and Maria, of course. Do you hear this from folks? Because I get it from folks. Every once in a while, you know, like my mom will be like, well, aren't you worried that the LSAT, the LSAT's going away, isn't it?
Well, so I don't hear it that often. And this actually relates to our dinner the other night. Maria left and we left and she was like, it sounds like Nathan talks about work more than you do. And I said, yeah, you know, I don't, I don't bring that home as much. And so maybe I'm just not talking about it as much. So maybe people don't even know that I'm in the LSAT world, but I don't hear this that often from my friends.
Yeah. I think you're just better natured than I am. I bitch and complain a lot, you know? So I complain about the problems in our industry, including the growing accommodations apocalypse, which, you know, we've talked about on previous episodes of Thinking LSAT. I think that's the biggest threat to the LSAT, actually. You know, we can address this news about the American Bar Association, Council on Legal Education. They had some resolution where they removed this requirement. I don't even know if this has been adopted yet by the full ABA. It's one of these things where it's like in committee and out of committee and back in committee and changing, and this is changing and that changing. And then you got 20 deans who write a letter on one side and 20 other deans who write a letter on the other side. And it's like, okay, is this ever going to happen or what? But all that's going to happen, even if it even does happen, is they are going to remove the requirement that law schools use an admissions test as part of their admissions process.
Yeah, which is, there is a key point too, right? Because it's not they're not even required to use the LSAT now. They just have to use an admissions test. Of course, they tend to favor the LSAT, so the all schools accept it. But okay, so the requirement's going away, and that's very different from a different situation, which would be to require the schools to not accept a test.
Yeah. Like, Ben, what if I told you that there was no more restriction? You weren't required to use your seatbelt when you drive.
Yeah, I could still use it. It's not like there's a law that says I can't use it. Like,
they're not going to come strip the seatbelt from your car. They're not going to start writing you a ticket if you do use your seatbelt.
Yep.
If you're somebody who sensibly uses your seatbelt, the requirement that you use your seatbelt really doesn't affect that. So law schools love the LSAT. Law schools heavily weight the LSAT in their admissions decisions. They are required to use an admissions test. They are not required to heavily weight that admissions test. In fact, there's no minimum weight on how much they're supposed to use that admissions test. And law schools have determined that LSAT, in addition to GPA, are going to be the two hugely overweighted factors in all of their admissions decisions. Every law school does this.
Yeah.
So if they are choosing to super heavily weight the LSAT, why would they suddenly stop using it entirely if they are no longer required to use an admissions test? This is an example of people just getting bad news, you know, clickbaity headlines or headlines that don't tell the full story. You know, ABA removes LSAT requirement, and people take away from that like, oh, so the LSAT's going away. No. They're removing, if it even happens, they're going to remove a requirement for schools to use a test that they love. And so we don't think it's going to affect law school admissions at all.
Yeah.
Games are going away. LSAT logic games are going away. As we previously discussed, the June test will be the last test that has logic games, at least in their current form. We have no idea what's going to happen in 25, 26, 27. You know, maybe some form of the games will come back. Maybe they'll tweak logical reasoning to be more like the old games. Who knows what they're going to do in the future? We do know that the test is shifting. Mm-hmm. There won't be games and there will be twice as much logical reasoning. But that's definitely not the LSAT going away. Check out our previous episode on LSAT accommodations, though, because that's the thing that to me seems like it could completely undermine the validity of the LSAT. With more and more people getting accommodations, and if the accommodations are too powerful, which we believe they are, you know, the minimum extra time that you can get is time and a half, which is just way too much. It's just not fair. Yeah. And we don't even know now, we don't have any new data since 2017 on how many people are getting accommodated. But we know that the trend was going up and up and up until 2017. And we haven't seen anything to indicate that that has reversed. In fact, we seem to think that it's like anecdotally, it seems like that's probably happening more and more now. And that, if I were a law school admissions person, that would be what would cause me, not the removal of the ABA requirement, but the fact that we don't really know what scores mean anymore because we don't know whether people are getting unfair accommodations. That, I think, is the real risk to the LSAT for law school admissions.
I agree totally. I was trying to think of an analogy, and I was thinking of like a marathon, right? So on average, people maybe spend 4 hours running a marathon. If you were looking at marathon results and 10, 15%, that's a number we don't know. We actually don't know the percentage, but let's assume it's 15% of the runners got a 2 hour head start.
Yeah. It's not like a little bit of a head start. It's like a really significant head start.
Yeah.
That's a decent analogy.
You don't know who got that head start. All you see is the end results. What do you make of them? Well, you don't know what percentage of people got the head start, and you don't know who they are.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Anyways.
For the record, because we're going to get hate mail. I'm sorry, Eric, producer Eric. We're going to get hate mail. But, you know, for the record, I don't think that all accommodations are unfair. I do think that accommodations are merited in certain circumstances. I'm not an expert on this at all. But I do know, though, that in 10 years now of doing this podcast, something like 10 years of doing this podcast, we've never heard anybody say that they've been denied accommodations. And time and a half is just too much. Like I there's also like all the stuff we were talking about at dinner, right? Mm-hmm. Where accommodations are highly related to access to healthcare, which is related to wealth, which is related to being white. It's like the accommodation system just obviously favors the wealthy and the privileged.
Exactly. Yeah, we're not talking about individual cases. We have no idea for any individual whether the accommodations they got or didn't get was the best outcome or the right outcome for them. But looking at the system as a whole, with that lawsuit requiring the law school admission council to give at a minimum time and a half, whereas before they could give 5 minutes or 10 minutes or something like that, things just, the system's not set up correctly.
The minimum time and a half is like, where the hell did they come up with that? That is so crazy. That's insane. You know, you mentioned a marathon, Ben, but imagine like a 100-meter dash.
Yeah.
And it's like, you only have to run, or, you know, I guess you either get a 50% head start, like in a 10-second race, you get a 5-second head start.
Mm-hmm.
Or I guess you only run like 2/3 as far.
2/3. Yeah, exactly.
But either way, it's like, well, how is that? Why is that the minimum accommodation?
Yep.
And all they were doing was like just trying to make accommodations, you know, and I'm not saying that it wasn't. I'm not saying that the balance wasn't swung the other way in an unfair direction
before. Sure.
Yeah. I mean, I think the asterisk really should go away.
Yeah. They would say, oh, this student got accommodations. That was revealed on your application. And that was taken away as part of the lawsuit.
Which I think they should have fair accommodations. It shouldn't be so easy to get them. Like, you shouldn't just be able to get any doctor's note and just automatically get accommodated. Yeah. They also shouldn't just roll over and give you whatever accommodations you ask for. I mean, we've had so many people say, oh, yeah, well, I was hoping for time and a half, but I asked for double time. they thought it was going to be like a negotiation. And then they asked for double time, and then they just were immediately granted double time. It's like, what? Yeah. How? Why is that not?
Yeah.
There's not any kind of like back and forth
pushback.
Or any kind
there's
of.
There's no.
Looking at
not
the actual circumstances
ownership.
Of the case. No, they're just like, oh, it's a doctor's note. Boom. Good. You're good.
That's not, they're washing their hands of this. They're saying, hey, that's not our decision. That's your doctor's decision. And
you have a prescription for depression, anxiety, ADHD, ADD, dyslexia. You have any prescription, any diagnosis? It's like, yep. They look at it for 2 seconds, I think, and they're just like, yep, rubber stamp, accepted.
Which, side note, are hugely on the rise. Why, I don't know exactly, but they're on the rise. So there are more and more people who are eligible now to apply for these things.
Yeah. And again, those people have access to healthcare, and those people have parents who are involved enough to go get the kid the diagnosis. It just tends to be richer, whiter folks. And to us, it just seems wildly unfair. But anyway, LSAT's not going anywhere is the answer to this question.
Yeah, that's what we were trying to say. Okay, several listeners wrote in to ask about applying to law school with a low GPA. Let's go through these. The first one's from Sandra.
2.6 GPA, straight A's in her last 2 years. Is there even a chance that law schools will accept me knowing that I have a terrible GPA? And is there anything I can do to supplement that? Why don't you read the next one from Kelly?
Sure. Kelly has a 2.4 GPA, raised 4 siblings while in undergrad. Oh, shit. Will my GPA render me ineligible for an accredited law school? Should I give up on this?
Last one's from Jonathan. How much weight goes into your GPA if you have an LSAT score above 170? Have you seen students get accepted based on higher GPA or higher LSAT scores when they have average scores for the other part of the equation? Oh, and then I guess we have another one. We have another anonymous listener who asked whether it's worth it to pursue grade forgiveness with their undergraduate institution. So we've got tons of emails coming in saying, hey, 2.6, 2.4, I got a good LSAT, but a crap GPA. What should I do about it? Including grade forgiveness. Is that something that's worth it? What do you say to all of this?
Okay. So first of all, yes, there are schools you can get into with low GPAs, even though they're low, because you can compensate with a high LSAT score. There are some schools that just say, hey, we don't care that your GPA is so low. They do care on some level, but they're willing to let that go if you can bring them a great LSAT score. And we see that too with the law school numbers, right? Or law school data, how the charts have these stark lines. And so as long as you get above their median in one of the things, either LSAT or GPA, then you're getting accepted. So that's not every school, but that is at a lot of schools. So yes, don't give up on this journey with a low GPA. You can rectify it with a high LSAT score. Also, when it comes to pursuing grade forgiveness, you absolutely should try. As you start that process, you may realize there's a lot more than may make it worth it, but you don't know until you try. And so I would at least start the process.
Yeah, not all schools are going to do it. And it depends on who you talk to at even at your individual school. I would encourage people to try like on different days at different times and
different
try
people.
To get a different administrator. apparently, Daniel Kahneman's new book, Noise, is about that, where it is about how different administrators in the exact same organization give different responses to things.
Wait, Danny has a new book? I'm sorry, because he just passed away.
Yeah, well, maybe it's not like new, but it's a couple of years ago. It's called Noise. And I haven't read it yet, so it's on my list. But I was listening to a podcast that was talking about it, where it's like administrators at some government and government insurance, like underwriters at a government insurance program, were asked to look at the exact same case. They were asked, okay, so how much should the award be in this case? They were also asked, how different do you think other underwriters will rate this case? And they said, yeah, we think it'll be X dollars. And we think most of the estimates are going to come in about 10% plus or minus this based on these facts.
Yeah.
True variance was more like 50%. You know, it's just like this big difference that you get. And what we're talking about here is like, how much should they pay out for somebody's broken leg or whatever? And,
Is this because people focus on particular facts differently and they may give more weight to a random fact in a way that someone else doesn't? Or
yeah, but apparently there's also studies that indicate, you know, I mean, when they do studies of you've read those studies of judges, right? Where it's like they've actually correlated it with like whether the judge's football team won that day or lost that day.
Oh, yeah.
Like can influence your sentencing.
Yeah. You're in a bad mood.
So, yeah. So it's just, before lunch or after lunch. I mean, there's just like a lot of things that can unfairly. So point is, if you've been told no, we can't change that C minus to a pass.
Hmm.
Or no, we can't scrub that F from your record. You know, you retook the class, but no, we can't remove the previous F from your record. Just because one person tells you no doesn't mean that somebody else is going to tell you no.
100%. Yeah.
So, totally, you know, you've tried phone, try phone again. You've tried email, try phone. You've tried both, try going in person.
Yeah.
I mean, be a lawyer and like exhaust all of your appeals and see if you can get those bad grades taken off your record. Now, to address the 2.6 and the 2.4, I mean, those are pretty much unredeemable. Like you'd have to get entire semesters of F's taken off your record in order to get those GPAs up to the median at any law school. So the answer for you people, Sandra and Kelly and folks who have 2 point something GPAs, you just need a really bitchin' LSAT to balance out the low grades. I mean, you're gonna lower the median GPA of their school. But if you could raise the median LSAT of their school, then now all of a sudden you become not only potentially an admit, but even possibly a scholarship. And the last thing that I want to say to these folks is getting into law school should not be your goal, especially for people who have low grades, because you've demonstrated that you're not that great at school. Now, maybe Sandra, you know, turned the corner, straight A's in her last 2 years.
Yep.
Although 2.6, Ben, with straight A's in your last 2 years.
Yeah. So what happened those first 2 years? That's
like straight D minuses for your first 2 years.
Yeah.
But
straight A's is that's no joke, right? So
yeah. And it's something that you can point to in an addendum.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's still just like, that's not going to do it. It doesn't really matter that much what you say in your addendum, because the fact is you're going to lower their GPA profile. That's one of the factors that US News uses when they rank law schools. You're going to hurt their US News. Your GPA is going to hurt their US News ranking.
Yeah.
No matter what your addendum says. You know, they read that addendum and it makes perfect sense to them. And they go, yeah, but it's going to lower my US News ranking. You know, so you need an LSAT that is going to raise their US News ranking. And I would strongly encourage you not to just try to get in, because if it turns out that you're not good at law school, then your job outcomes are not going to be good. Go to LSATdemon.com/scholarships and play around with the scholarship estimator. You know, 2.6 and a 170, that'll get you some good offers. 2.4 and a 170, that'll get you some good offers.
Totally.
All right.
This next one is from Anonymous. The subject is pass-fail option. I'll go ahead and read it. It says, hi, Ben and Nathan. I'm currently a junior in college with a GPA of 3.97. And if all goes well, I will have a 3.98 after the end of this semester. That 3.98 would be the GPA I applied to law school with. But we'll have to see what happens once you put it into the LSAC's translator. It might go up or down.
Yeah.
But anyways, I got 1 B+ during the fall of my freshman year, but I have maintained straight A's since. However, I'm currently taking a course for my minor that has a strict curve, and I'm very unlikely to get an A. I will likely get a B+ or an A-. This will bring me down to a 3.95 at the time of my application. Should I opt to take this course pass fail? This will save my GPA. This will save my GPA, but it will show up as a satisfactory rather than a letter grade. Additionally, if I opt for the pass fail option, I will have to drop my minor, leaving me with just one major and no minors. Is this something I should do? Do law schools care about minors? No, they don't. Will law schools frown on using the pass-fail option to save my GPA? No, they'll have no idea why you did it. Just do it. Don't worry about these These are, it's like, what is it? It's just noise. I mean, you said that noise earlier for the title of that book. This stuff is noise. What's not noise is your GPA and your LSAT score.
Law schools are intensely interested in their U.S. News ranking. No matter how much law schools shit on U.S. News rankings, they pay more attention to U.S. News rankings even than their applicants do.
Yes.
I got a bunch of text messages yesterday from a student at Arizona Law. Arizona is now outside the top 50. It dropped another point. It dropped a single point in the new rankings. And their dean sent like a 3-page email out to the entire school community complaining about how U.S. News doesn't reflect the real story.
Well, if you don't give a shit about the rankings, then you wouldn't even notice. But they're protesting so much, it just reveals their insecurity about the rankings.
Law school deans get hired and fired based on their ability to change the rankings because applicants stupidly pay way too much attention to the rankings. I know from experience, Ben, I went to UC Hastings, now UC San Francisco Law.
Yep.
I went to that school. I had scholarship options at USF and Golden Gate, which Golden Gate doesn't even exist anymore. And USF has fallen even farther in the rankings. But the big loser in yesterday's new rankings was UC Hastings, falling another 20 something points in the rankings, down all the way now to 80 something. Like when I went to Hastings, it was like 40th in the country.
Yeah.
And now just 10 years later, it's 80 something in the country.
Yeah.
And I don't think the quality of the school has actually changed at all. It's just the stupidity of the U.S. News rankings.
Yeah. To see that in action, right? You can go to lsatdemon.com/rankings. And we have a graph that shows this seesaw of every school going up and down, up and even the top schools.
It's a zero sum game, right? It's not possible for all schools to raise their ranking because it's a relative ranking to one another.
Yeah.
And so and they change wildly over time.
Yeah.
I mean, they crazily move around over time. And I think if you look at any school, you'll realize, oh, shit. You know, I guess the top 14 doesn't change that much, although even the top 14 does. When are we going to stop saying the top 14? Because they're not the same schools every year.
I don't know.
It's like the top 12 never change. You know, they kind of shuffle around amongst themselves, but the edges of the top 14 are a little blurry. And anyway. Anonymous. 3.98 is better than 3.95, especially when you're looking at the very top schools. And having a satisfactory instead of an A minus, it's better. The minor, there's no way that schools can even account for that it ain't going into a spreadsheet.
Yeah.
What's going into a spreadsheet is your LSAT and your GPA.
Sorry, I'm a little distracted here because I am playing around with the lsatdemon.com/rankings tool, and I'm looking at Texas A&M University. So our chart doesn't show schools that are higher ranked or lower ranked than 100 because it's just too much information. So I was looking at schools that have gone below 100 and come back. And Texas A&M is one of those schools. And boy, in like 2017, it was below in the hundreds. And now, every year, it's shot up. And it went from 100 and whatever to 92 to 80 to 83. And then 60 and then 46 and now 29. It's like, what the hell are they doing there? I have no idea. But for a school to change so dramatically also means that other schools are dropping as dramatically.
I'm going to try to drill into Texas A&M a little bit. On their 2023 Standard 509 information report, we see 92% of the school getting grants, 48% getting half to full tuition, 19% getting full tuition, 3% getting more than full tuition. So they're going after, you know, they're playing that scholarship game pretty hard.
Yeah.
You can visualize it by looking at the roll call tool, which if you just click on any school on our scholarship estimator, you'll look at the roll call tool and you can see that, we got 2% on full ride plus stipend. We've got 19%, an additional 19% on a full ride. And then we've got 50% paying something less than half. So you add all that up and you get, 71% of the class
that's
paying something less than half tuition. I mean, that's how law schools, at least in the short run, are able to increase their ranking.
Yep.
As soon as they stop giving away those scholarships, though, and you've got to think that the piper has to be paid at some point, right? So when they stop giving those scholarships, then their LSAT and GPA profile will fall and their ranking will also fall.
Yep.
The question for them is, can you keep the 7% that are currently paying full tuition? Like, can you float the school on those 7% of people? Plus the, 22% are paying half tuition or more. So you've got, 29% of the school that is paying half or more of your nominal tuition of $49,000 for non-resident, $32,000 for resident.
I think this leads into the thing that you shared on the agenda, and that is that this tuition right now is $49,000, but one way to pay the piper, right, is to raise that nominal fee so that, quote, more people who are paying less than half, whatever that is, that number still goes up next year by raising the tuition from 49,000 to 54,000 or whatever they decide to raise it to.
Which every school does every year. I mean, they raise the tuition by more than inflation pretty much every year at every school.
Yeah, let's talk about that. What is this thing that you found?
Oh, God. Yeah. So here's another thing that I was yelling about at dinner the other night. The story that I told at dinner was we went to the Senate. My mom and dad and I went to the U.S. Senate.
Yep.
And we actually got to see the morning business where the Senate Majority Leader came in and he read like a 5-page speech, basically, that was talking about all the things that the Democrats are doing and all the things that the Republicans are not. And
that's the agenda for the day.
Well, in addition to some bipartisan shit that was like, we're calling for the release of some American hostage or something like that.
Sure.
It's like that, something that obviously everybody can agree on. And then everything else they just disagree on. But one of the things that he was super proud of, and I had seen it earlier in the Times.
Mm.
So New York Times Daily Email, 2 bullets right next to each other in this morning email.
Yeah.
With no fucking commentary, like no analysis or anything. First bullet, some colleges will soon charge $100,000 a year. That's undergrad, not law school. But the same shit's happening in law school.
Yep. Yep.
Next bullet. President Biden will announce student debt relief for millions of borrowers in a Wisconsin speech. And, that's one thing that that Schumer was, I think it was Schumer. I'm not like a politics sports fan, so I don't even know who's who. But, whoever the Democrat was that was reading, he was super proud of Biden's student debt relief plan.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I'm just like, how do you keep, it's like the government is paying for, or I don't know, the analogy is going to fall apart a little bit, but it's like the government is just shipping truckloads of donuts to everybody in the country And then also paying everybody in the, like, paying for Ozempic.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, it's just like, the fuck are we doing? Are you kidding me? How can you possibly think it's good policy to announce student debt relief at the same time that tuitions are allowed to just wildly inflate with no limit?
Yeah.
Well, I'm not saying student debt relief is bad. It's not bad in a vacuum.
No.
It's just, it seems to me to be obvious pandering where it's just like, well, okay, but that doesn't solve any kind of a problem. All it does is it gets votes right now, makes some people feel good about themselves right now. But then the problem continues getting worse and worse and worse because the U.S. Department of Education guarantees all these loans that people continue to take out, like, increasingly every single year.
Yeah. It actually makes the problem worse, right? Because what they're doing is they're looking at individuals who may or may not be victims of a bad system, fair, and they're saying, oh, we're going to help these victims, but the people who are helping the victims are the taxpayers, as opposed to the people who caused the problem, which is the schools. They're complicit in this. They're raising their rates in response to these loans, and now we're saying, oh, yeah, and these loans are going to be forgiven, so students are going to be even more risk, tolerant, more willing to take out loans, and the schools are more willing to charge more. Yeah.
What message would you think you might take if you're 21 years old? Well, I mean, 17 years old and making a decision about where to go for undergrad, or 22 years old and making a decision about where to go for law school. It's like, well, I mean, look, Biden is just going in and relieving all of this debt. You know, billions of dollars for millions of borrowers. Why wouldn't I go pay full price? Why wouldn't I just go to the top ranked school that I can get into and pay $100,000 a year for undergrad, or pay $70,000 a year to go to law school? Why wouldn't I do that? Because it looks as if this debt is going to get relieved.
Yeah. And people will probably realize that it's not necessarily going to get relieved, but that's not the point. The point is, hey, either I'm going to make enough money and not worry about it, or I'm not going to make enough money and someone will come in and help me. And then there's the other side of it, which is the schools, which are just sitting there watching this all happen and saying, okay, raise the rates. Well, why not? No one's going to push back on it because the students aren't going to push back on it.
Yeah. It's like our problem with wildly inflating healthcare costs, where, you know,
there's a disconnect.
The insurance companies are the ones that are actually paying, so the doctor has no incentive to lower the rates because the person who's actually going and getting the medical services isn't going to be the one who's paying anyway. So what, you know, it's just, but then insurance rates keep going up and up and up.
Yeah.
And because you got this just totally dysfunctional.
Yeah.
This dysfunctional weird triangle thing. Well, the same thing's going on with colleges and with law schools. And so, you know, I don't have a team politically. I am pretty socially progressive, and I am no fan of Trump, but I see this policy and it's just like, wow, really? That's what we're doing?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to continue to let the problem get worse and worse and worse and worse and worse, but we're going to treat some symptoms.
But it's weird because the side effect of treating this symptom is actually to make the symptom worse.
Right.
So it's like a pill that it's like a pain med or something. It like takes away the pain, but the underlying problem is still festering.
It's like free liposuction and truckloads of donuts at the same time. You know, it's like, well, at great expense, we'll go in and suck some of this fat out of your body, but we're not going to stop the shipments, the truckloads of donuts that are still headed out to every house in America.
Yeah. Yeah. Ugh.
Okay. Enough of that.
Yeah. This next one is from Anonymous. The subject is personal statement. When is the most interesting story not worth telling?
Hmm.
Okay.
Hi, guys. This may be a niche question, but I would appreciate any advice you can offer. I'm an international humanitarian aid worker in an undisclosed location. And I am applying for law school this upcoming cycle. My personal statement is focused on the reason I am motivated to go to law school, which is inextricably linked with the emergency my organization is responding to. Unfortunately, I am unable to provide specifics of where I am working or the details of a government partnership, which provides context for the circumstances that sparked my initial interest. I'm writing the personal statement in general terms at this point, but I worry that generalizing the terms of my personal statement will dilute the potency of the narrative and unnecessarily confuse the admissions audience. The most interesting story about my personal and professional life is rooted in this assignment, but I think clarity in writing is likely more important than how interesting the story is. Advice?
My advice is to find something else and write about that. If you're going to have this vague statement that alludes to things, I think it's going to be more off-putting than just picking something else in your life that's concrete that you can then talk about. And I think you're also underestimating the amount of things in your life that you can write about, right? Every day we do several things. You're telling me that there's not one other thing outside of this experience that you can't be proud of and write about and that illustrates your professionalism and your potential to do well in law school and beyond. I doubt it.
Yeah, and like this just isn't going to fly. You writing about undisclosed locations and emergencies that you can't describe at all, you know, a government partnership that you can't say anything about, it's not an interesting story.
Yeah.
It's fucking boring. I'm sorry. Because there's no specifics there. Mm-hmm. So I'm like, are you in Gaza? Are you in Ukraine? Are you at the border? Are you like, where are you? I have no idea where you are. I have no idea who you work for. I have no idea what you're doing. It either sounds like you're unnecessarily obfuscating and potentially just like lying and telling a story that's not even true because you're not providing any details that could in any way be substantiated. I'm not saying you are. I'm just saying that that's the effect that comes off.
Yes. Yes.
You know, so it sounds like that. It's confusing. Yeah, I just don't I like if you can't share any details with a couple of podcasters, how are you possibly going to be able to actually share, you know, how are you possibly going to write a statement that's going to be even readable? So write about the second most interesting thing in your life.
Yep. All right, this next one is from Anonymous. The subject is withdrawing from a master's degree, ? Hi, Ben and Ethan. I'm currently in my last year of undergrad, and I'm in an accelerated master's program that my school offers. Basically, it lets you start a master's degree during your senior year and then finish 1 year after graduating instead of two. I applied because I thought it would boost my law school application. Okay. But after listening to you guys, I'm not sure it would. My undergrad scholarship is not getting extended, so I'd have to take out loans to finish grad school. But I don't want to do anything in the future with this degree. I just want to be a lawyer. Should I withdraw after only finishing 1 year? How would law schools view this? There will be some grad classes on my undergrad transcripts since some of them counted for undergrad requirements. I don't want to take out loans for something that isn't going to boost my law school application, but will not finishing the degree make me look bad. Wow, it sounds like you already know the answer to this question, Anonymous. Like, stop.
I don't think law schools are necessarily even going to see this on your application.
Yeah, they'll just see your classes that you took for it, but they won't know that it was for your degree. They'll just think it was classes you took while you were an undergrad.
You took master's classes while you were an undergrad and they counted for your undergrad education. Great. How's that hurt your case?
Yep.
I just don't know that they ever even know that you were in an accelerated master's program. You got an undergrad from that school. Even if they did know that you were in an accelerated master's program and you chose to just apply to law school instead, if the rest of your application is good, if you've got good grades, good LSAT, if you've got a compelling personal statement, sounds like you're pretty convinced that you just want to be a lawyer, then why the hell would they ever even care?
Yeah. In fact, it could be smart. I mean, it could be a pivot. You were going down this one path and you're like, nope, this is not what I want to do. Why waste any more time and money pursuing something that's not going to help you?
It sounds like a no-brainer that you should drop this program. I mean, nobody should spend money on master's programs.
Yeah,
I have two master's degrees and I got them both for free. Master's programs play the same kinds of scholarship games that law schools do. I had a full ride because of a high GRE for my journalism master's. I had a full ride because of a high GMAT for my MBA. And I just can't imagine the value that people got paying for, you know, they were paying for my degree in addition to paying for their degree if they weren't there on a scholarship. And as far as law school is concerned, law schools don't look at your grades from graduate programs. They only look at your undergraduate GPA. And the JD really does trump all master's degrees in the legal field. I mean, you need the LSAT. You need the JD. It is both necessary and sufficient for legal practice. And, or at least to set the bar.
Yeah.
And whatever this master's is, it's not necessary, nor is it sufficient. It's a waste of time. And for you, it would also be a waste of money. So yeah, I agree, Ben. I think that this correspondent knows what's the correct decision here and is just asking for our stamp of approval, which granted.
All right. An LSAT demon student worked with Leslie. Leslie is our personal statement editor, admissions helper. To write an
admissions
appeal.
Expert, increasingly our admissions expert. She has been putting together all of our admissions resources to create our new admissions course, which is coming soon. And she is learning more and more. I mean, she's been at this for years, helping people with their personal statement, with their other optional essays for law school, helping people with all kinds of admissions related issues, and is, I would call her, if I'm not going to call her an expert, I'm going to call her a very advanced student of law school admissions. She knows more about admissions, I think, than probably anybody else on our team.
For sure. So she's working with a student, or she worked with a student to write an appeal for an extra test attempt. And this is from Leslie.
She writes, one of her scores was a cancel, but still counted because LSAC had offered a retake date, but she was out of the country and unable to take it that day. Her PTs are currently 7 to 11 points higher than her best official score. She heard back in 6 days with a successful appeal and was allowed to take the test a sixth time.
Awesome.
We also have Demon team member Kevin, who was allowed to take it a sixth time. I can't remember exactly what Kevin's appeal was based on. Oh, yeah, right. So Kevin had an interruption on his fifth attempt and filed an appeal to take it a sixth time. Hmm. It's one of these things where they just default say no. You know, they have a policy, but then they have an appeals procedure. And if you're smart about the way you write your appeal, you know, they don't want to like deny you if it's going to become a pain in the ass.
Mm-hmm.
So they can just quietly say yes, not change their policy, but just quietly allow it. And yeah, for somebody like this, for Leslie's student who, man, if you're scoring 7 to 11 points higher on your PTs than your highest best official and you've exhausted your 5 attempts, figure out some way to make an appeal. See if you can get that through.
Yeah,
because this student has a very good chance of improving their LSAT. You know, even if they don't score 7 to 11 points higher, even if they only score 3 or 4 or 5 points higher, that's still $50,000 worth of scholarship money at some school.
You know, I would say this especially to people who can't seek accommodations. They're hearing that discussion about the accommodations and wondering, you know, what can I do? Well, one thing you can do is if you've taken all 5 of your attempts and you feel like you can do better, here's something you can apply for. Maybe you can't apply for accommodations, but you can apply for another test. Take it.
Yeah. You can also like try to exhaust all of your appeals on rehabilitating your undergraduate GPA, even if you yes. have high grades. What's your worst grade? Do you have any kind of a case for getting that worst grade changed into a pass? Or yeah. do you have some retaken class where you forgot to withdraw and you got an F, but then you retook it and got an A, but now both of those are on your transcript? If you talk to your undergraduate institution and if you try a few different angles, like a lawyer, you might be surprised. You know, if you just ask one person, you're likely to run into somebody who says, nah, we can't do anything. But if you try multiple times and you act like a lawyer about it, if you're a squeaky enough wheel, you know, you might get the grease. So there are things that you can do to play this game, even if accommodations aren't the thing for you.
For sure. All right, let's go to word of the week. This one is from Sid. The subject is resource to become a gladiator of the English language. Gladiator of the English language, that's a phrase that you came up with. Nathan, you've been saying that for years. I don't know.
I have been saying that for years. I think that the English language is the weapon that you're going to use as a lawyer. I mean, the reason why you're going to be a good lawyer is because you're a better reader and writer than the other lawyer. You're going to understand the documents better. You're going to understand the statutes better. You're going to understand the regulations better. You're going to understand the case law better. You're going to understand whatever documents are as evidence in the case. You're going to understand those documents better. You're going to understand your brief better. You're going to understand the opposing counsel's brief better. And you're going to add up all of that. And it's like, yeah, you're a gladiator of the English language. So this email says, hey, Ben and Nathan, love listening to the podcast and appreciate you answering a prior question about being a gladiator of the English language. I'm not sure if anyone has sent this in before, but either way, wanted to share this free resource below. You can subscribe to a word of the day email from Merriam-Webster, and it emails you every morning with a new word. I get excited every day for this email, and it's been a great way to grow my vocabulary. I try and challenge myself to use that word at work each day to practice my understanding of it. Thank you again. So yeah, that's Merriam-Webster word of the day.
Cool. I'm going to sign up for it.
Okay.
What's
the word of the day today?
Vicarious.
Oh, that's you experience something vicariously. Yeah. So
through someone else or something like that.
Yeah. So like if my sister and her kids were at Disneyland and they FaceTimed me or whatever, you know, I would experience their Disney day vicariously through them.
Yeah.
Neat.
Maybe if other people who listen to this podcast sign up for word of the day, we can all see the same words.
Even better tip than that.
Yeah.
Read books and look up words. I look up half a dozen words a day.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I mean, it's a habit that I started recently.
Yeah.
But it's so interesting. And I'm sure that it helps me become a more precise user of the English language. I know I've made this pitch a million times on the show, but Kindle makes it so easy. I mean, you just click on the word and you immediately get a definition. And I can do that in bed, you know, in dark mode, reading myself to sleep. But it's like, oh, that's an interesting use of that word. Or, oh, I've never heard that word before at all. And just quick, get the definition right there in context while you're reading a story.
Totally.
And, that to me is even more appealing than this word of the day email.
You've mentioned this before, but just to clarify to everyone who's listening, when you look up those half a dozen words every day, maybe half of those are words you know, but you're seeking clarification on? Is that fair?
Yeah, I mean, either... Right. It'll be like, well, I can see what they're doing there, but it strikes me as not the word I would have chosen, or like, oh, that's just, that's an interesting word in that spot.
Or I've used that word differently elsewhere.
Right. So and you can look it up and here? you you can read not just the first definition, but the second, third definition, and you can, and maybe sometimes get like the etymology of the word, and you can see, oh, I see the roots of this word. Here's why they're using that word in that spot. That's really interesting. So it's not just looking up words that you don't know at all, although that is highly recommended, but looking up, I mean, hey, you got to sharpen your sword, right? Like you know how to use that sword, but you got to keep it sharp. And so looking up words that, you know, it's like maybe it's a relatively mundane word to you, but when you see it in some unexpected context, you go, oh, huh, okay, interesting. Look that up. Or yeah. It's a word that you've seen a million times in context, you know, vicariously might be a word that you've read it, you've seen it a million times in context, but you've never like actually looked at the definition.
Sure.
And that can also be an opportunity to learn more about the English language.
Be LSAT famous. Please ask questions or share news with us on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or on our socials at LSAT Demon. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, email help@lsatdemon.com. You can also check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 450 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you. Don't pay for law school.